Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you may be. Welcome to CCNA Discovery 1, Module 2 with Elise and Jackie on behalf of the Cisco Academy for the Vision Impaired. How are you going, Magic J?
I'm turning into a barbecued blind Cisco prof.
Oh no, we can't have that. Not this, well, I suppose we can at this time of year. Stay in the air conditioning and you'll be right, because we don't want to fry you at the moment. Wait till after the lecture.
It's 44 degrees Celsius or 112 Fahrenheit here in Phoenix, folks. Welcome to the desert.
Oh, and I've got it all to look forward to, but it might temper down to the low 30s, high 20s by the time I get there, because in Melbourne it's drizzly and 7 degrees, 8 degrees centigrade, and the sun is yet to rise in about 15 minutes' time. There you go, stark contrast. All right, folks, are there any questions concerning Module 1? That was all that last week's stuff we did. I might add that the quality of work that's been coming in from both sets of students, that is students who are doing the course the second time and students who are here for the first time, is excellent. So keep up the good work, gang. We're just looking at that, and we are just absolutely loving the work that's coming in. So well done, folks. I don't think I have anything else to say other than answer any questions, which there appear not to be there. Then just watch out some of those exam questions. They are out to get you in this. They are out to use every little trick in the English language. So reread your questions when you do your exams, and make sure that you are that you're happy with your answers.
Should we start on operating system?
Absolutely. I should have mentioned that when we started. Operating systems. I'll have to put that into the introduction, won't I? Anyway, Module 2, Operating Systems. You're up, Jay.
Yeah, welcome to ITE 1, Part 2. Or 2.
It's a bit like
something.
That, isn't it?
Yeah, that's about it. Sorry about this, guys, but we've got to cover what the curriculum says. So, let's get on with it. And, like I said, welcome to ITE Semester 2. Obviously, the operating system is an integral part of the computer. How you interact with the computer and the applications it can run very definitely affects our ability to communicate with other people. An operating system enables you to do the following: use application software, store information, and join the network. It is the absolutely most important program running on the computer, and without it, the other programs and features do not operate. Basically, if you do not have an operating system, you may have the hardware, you may have other software, but you don't have a functioning computer. You're going to learn in this chapter about the most popular operating systems, as well as how to choose one that is right for you. And you should also be able to describe the purpose of an operating system, identify common popular operating systems, perform an installation of an operating system, and configure the computer's operating system to participate on the network, as well as maintain the operating system. And maybe there needs to be an operating system that can assist my throat. Anyway, Elise, it's up to you. Go for it.
Thank you, girlfriend. Well, as you know, with computer bits and pieces like peripherals and everything that's inside the computer, it's really just a bunch of useless electronic junk. Available at the swap meet at your town hall on a Sunday morning. No, you can actually get some good stuff at swap meets. You can also get some good shops stuff from computer shops too. So there you go. Okay, swap meets are what we have in Australia when a whole heap of people get in trade and sell cheaply and somewhat surreptitiously lots of computer stuff.
We have them in All the right. US too.
Oh, you got them there? Oh, good. Yeah. All right. So, in other words, to bring all this junk together and actually make it all sing and dance, and in some cases do it sing and dance properly, you need a special program. And that program's called what, everybody?
Operating system.
Thanks, Gary. I knew somebody
there's one person
to get
we haven't put to sleep yet.
Yeah, I know. Suppose that a user wants to write a report and send it to their printer. They'll use a word processor. Well, you don't say. The information is entered from the keyboard, and it turns up on the screen somehow, and eventually turns up on the printer if you don't run out of ink. So, and in between that time, it actually winds up on the disk drive. Wow, how about that? Now, managing all this is the operating system. So basically, the word processor you use, or the chat program you use, or the voice over IP program like Ventrilo, has to be compatible with your operating system. Okay, in addition to all this, of course, yeah, pretty much. In addition to all this, the processed data is entered into RAM and processed by the CPU. Wow, we learned all this in IT, gang. It's also controlled by the operating system. All computers, such as servers, desktops, handheld devices, anything, has an operating system. And it needs it to function. The OS basically acts like a translator between the user and the hardware, basically. I'm just going to paraphrase some of this because I'm sure we all did IT one. Okay, application programs differ from operating systems. Of course, they're designed for a specific application or task, like a word processor is designed for word processing. Wow. These programs absolutely know nothing of the underlying electronics. They probably wouldn't want to know about the underlying electronics. For example, the application is not concerned about how the information is entered into the application from the keyboard. In other words, person hammers away on the keyboard, it's the operating system that looks after this and gives it to the application. When the computer is powered on, it loads the OS. Yes, I'll have a look at IT 1, Chapter 5, and you'll find out how. The operating system's loaded into RAM. The portion of the operating system code that interacts directly with the hardware is called the kernel. Yes, and without a kernel, we wouldn't have KFC. There you go, Colonel Sanders. Nor would we have an operating system. The portion of the operating system, of course, that interfaces with the user is known as the what?
Shell.
Shell.
And there's two more people we haven't got to sleep so far. Wacko. The user can interact with the shell using either one of two methods. What are they, gang?
Command line and GUI.
Geez, Joe, we're going to have to do something about your audio, old son. It's pretty loud. Okay, because both Kylie got in there under you too. Kylie, yell harder. Okay, let's look at the first one, the command line interface.
Hey, you know what? This could be a pretty fun semester to play Jeopardy between Shanley and Maloney over here.
Well, we do make that unofficially available, the Jeopardy session. Joe doesn't know about that. okay, well, yes, the guys and the girls, and the Maloney and the Shanley show. Wacko. Okay, CLI, which is what I like on Linux, and I can access that from a terminal window or on the console. The nice, evil, big black box when you go Windows key run and type in, CMD, you get a command line interface, and you can hammer commands out on your keyboard, press enter, and if you haven't done it right, you'll get a nasty message, but if you have done it right, your computer will obey you. Wow. The system executes the command, often providing text output. Wow. And I'm mentioning the Linux and DOS command line here, and we like the Linux and DOS command lines. There you go. The graphical user interface, a la Windows, Mac OS, the Amiga, the old Commodore Amiga in the old days, and even the GNOME graphical user interface under Linux, all have pictures and icons and nice little things for site links to click on. So basically, it says here in the notes, it allows the user to interact with the system using graphical images, multimedia, and text. Oh, and text. I suppose you do see text on a graphical user interface. I was labelling buttons yesterday in the application, wasn't I, Jackie? Okay, in my Jaws scripting knife. Yes, you usually interact with these images on the screen, usually with a mouse or a trackball. Oh, Jaws cursor. The GUI, or graphical user interface, is more user-friendly. Yeah, okay. And usually requires less knowledge by the user. For this reason, many individuals rely on the GUI environment to get their work done. Most operating systems these days offer both CLI and GUI interfaces. The shell, not something we find on the beach, but this is the interface that allows the user to request specific tasks from the computer. These requests can be made either through the CLI or GUI. The kernel is the bit of code that communicates between the hardware and the software of the computer. And it also manages how hardware resources are used to meet software requirements. The hardware, yes, that's the bit you stomp on if you don't like your computer. This is the physical components of the computer, including the underlying electronics. Example, motherboard, hard drive, RAM, expansion cards like video and sound cards, etc. Operating systems have complete control of local hardware resources. They are designed to use with one user at a time. Oh, they do enable the user to multitask, and the operating system does keep track of which resources are used by which application. My apologies. So there you go. It does keep track of what's been used by the application. Okay. Now here's where we get into some of the nitty gritty here. In order for your system to work with resources that are not directly connected to your computer system, a special piece of software must be added that allows your devices to send and receive data to the network. This software is known as a redirector. The redirector may be an integral part of your operating system or may need to be installed separately as a network client. Well, there you go. So most operating systems have all this sort of stuff built in. When installed, the operating system becomes, you guessed it, a nose. Does anyone remember what a nose is? Other than the one on your face. And Kylie got it, network operating system. At this point, are there any questions? Did you want to mic up there, Joe? Johannes, sorry?
No questions.
Excellent. A nose on network operating system offers complex scheduling and allows devices to share resources as though they are directly connected. Simply this, there's a diagram here in the notes that depicts a desktop PC connected to a cloud, and we'll talk about the cloud in coming chapters. The cloud represents a network, or often used to represent the internet. A document is prepared for transmission at the client end. The animation outlines the steps that are required to send this document out onto the network by using the redirector component of your operating system. One, I need access to a network resource. Wow. Okay, the redirector says, quote, that's a network resource. I will take care of that, unquote. The document is then moved into the cloud. Okay, with your operating system requirements, we always have to be aware of this sort of stuff. As of course you know, there are many different operating systems available. There are. The major groupings are as follows. Alright, the Microsoft Windows family of operating systems. Okay, that's, you know, Windows XP, Vista, Windows 7, Windows Server 2003, Windows Server 2000 and whatever, etc. Okay, we've got the Unix-based operating systems, sort of IBM, AIX, the Hewlett-Packard HP UX, and Sun Solaris. We've got the BSD operating systems, which are free. And we've got the Linux-based operating systems, many flavors of that, which are also free. And they come in the form of Ubuntu, which is what Kerry likes, and Fedora, which is what I like. Also, you've got CentOS, and Jackie's been playing around with Vinix. There's a whole stack of Linux flavors out there, and some are sort of more suited to tasks than others, or some are just simply liked better than others. You've got the Macintosh OS, and the latest one being, of course, Snow Leopard. Hello, all you voiceover, voiceover people out there. And of course, you've got the old, God, that's still mentioned, IBM/OS, the OS 400. Good grief, that's going back a bit. Most of these operating systems require the user to purchase and agree to a commercial license. There are several operating systems released under a different type of licensing scheme known as the new general public, the new public license, or GPL.
Actually, it's pronounced GNU, folks.
GNU, yes. So there you go, GNU. All right.
That's the stuff birds make.
Actually, it's a sort of a cow type thing, isn't it?
No, that's a bat. Except that's kind of like guano.
Guano.
I'm sure GNU is like a cow or a deer or something bovine like that.
Anyway, it's spelled GNU, but it's pronounced GNU for whatever reason.
Yeah, or you can even jump in a canoe. No, different kettle of fish, that one. Okay. Commercial licenses usually deny users the ability to modify the OS. So there you go. Okay, so I've just said it. What's an example of a commercial OS? OS. Gang.
XP.
Yep, it's one example. What about its current biggest rival?
I suppose Snow Leopard would be another one.
That's what I was looking for, thanks Johannes. Yep, Snow Leopard. And of course with the breakdown, because the marketers have got to it all, XP comes in many, many different flavours, like Media Edition, Home, and Professional. Actual fact, it only got worse under Vista and 7. There's Home Office, Home Premium, and Student, and God only knows, I've lost track of all the OS ones, all the different flavours.
They don't refer to it as version hell for no reason.
Yeah, pretty much. Another one that's mentioned here is Unix itself, not Linux, but Unix. In contrast to GPL, is something that, of course, it's open and allows users to modify the code and make enhancements, and a lot of people do in Linux. Much of what happens there is because of the community. Linux and BSD are the two that are sort of released under the GPL. Now, much of this is in your notes, but it's just rephrasing what I've said, just puts it here in the bullet points. Some of the advantages and disadvantages with the commercial license. Costs can be very expensive depending on deployment. Generally, an XP license, I'll probably the same with Vista and 7, of course, the license has to be purchased for every machine that's running it. A lot of places obviously run site licenses. The development cycle is very structured, and changes are not quickly available. So there you go. Support, yes, available for a fee. You try ringing up the Microsoft help desk and getting them to help you for nothing, forget it. With the GPL license, basically access ensures that everyone has access to be able to make changes by having access to the source code and can participate in its enhancements. Cost often released free of charge. Yeah, beauty, we like free operating systems. For example, Linux can be installed on as many computers as you want to put it on. So there you go. I currently have it on 3 of my 4 computers, I do believe. 1, 2, 3, actually, before I did my 5 computers. There you go. And yes, I generally do dual boot clever things anyway. More on that later. The development cycle for Linux and these open source operating systems is usually less structured, and changes are usually implemented quickly. So there you go, the development cycle is less structured, it says here. Although most of the two major distributions are releasing new versions every 6 months, for the Ubuntu and Fedora. Support, less of a structured support. Yes, you said it, you can't go unless you go and buy the Red Hat Enterprise Edition. You can't ring anyone up unless you have friends, and then you can ring them up for help. Often relying on community user-based support, which is pretty much what I said, ring a friend. All operating systems require a certain amount of hardware resources. These resources are usually specified by the manufacturer. So there you go, look at the ACL guys if you're in doubt as to whether your computer will run the operating system you wish to install. Usually these things include the amount of RAM, or random access memory, the amount of hard disk space required to install it onto, processor type and speed, and video resolution. Manufacturers often specify both a minimum and recommended level of hardware resources. So there you go. Just because you're meeting the minimum hardware resources doesn't necessarily mean to say your operating system will run particularly well. So it's better to go for the recommended, or of course, recommended or higher. And it says here in the notes the recommended option is more likely to support standard additional applications and resources. Are there any questions at this point? All right, well,
as usual, they do not mention the hidden costs in antivirus software for the commercial software.
Yeah, funny about that. Well, in actual fact, it goes on here about additional hardware, but it doesn't say about additional software. That's exactly right, Johannes. Oddly enough, you can get a good one for Linux, which is free. ClamNav comes built into that. Yes, there are free...
And I would say that Avast is probably one of the best antivirus solutions out there, and it too is free.
Yeah, there are. I was just about to say that, Jay. There are free and paid-for virus scanners out there, and I would agree with Jay on her comments with Avast. We're actually running it here, free ones, and I don't think we're running any paid-for ones, but we are running paid-for other virus scanners, and it is pretty good for free.
Look, I've seen paid versions of antivirus software miss viruses that the free version of Avast has picked up. I've seen that, not on just one occasion, but multiple occasions. So there are some free and very good solutions out there.
Yeah, exactly. To take advantage of additional features provided by an operating system, you often need to have additional hardware resources such as sound cards and network interface cards on NICs. Microphones and speakers are generally required too. Many of the hardware Many of the iOS developers test various hardware devices and certify that they are compatible with their operating systems. Aura is verified. It says here in the notes the hardware has been certified to work with a particular operating system before buying it and installing it. Yeah, well, okay.
The reason why Lisa's saying, yeah, well, okay, is because, as most of you probably already know, that's not always able to be done. Certainly a lot of the manufacturers, especially in the early stages of an operating system, haven't put out drivers yet. And yet, many times the old driver will work on the new operating system. Sometimes it won't, though, and it can sure ham over things if it doesn't. Create a restore point and back up your data.
Yep. Check your hardware compatibility list, or HCL, to see if your operating system, or before you install your operating system. Oh, wacko, we have some more interaction coming up. I left it in. Okay, now I'm going to ask some questions here to the students. So you got this part of the notes up, Jay? Okay, here we go. We have a student activity for everybody here. What we're going to do is ask you some questions to see what type of operating system, what type of license. Match the type of license the four scenarios below. Here we go. Scenario one. Jackie runs a small interior design company. I never knew you did that, Jay. Wow, how about that? Jackie, it says here in the notes, runs a small interior design company. She has three interior designers working for her, and none of them have a great deal of knowledge about computers or operating systems. They require an operating system that is easy to use and offers highly structured support. What license do they want?
Have to be commercial.
Yep. Absolutely. They want to go and buy a Mac or a Windows-based operating system. Amy, I too... Oh, no wonder Jay went quiet. You all right, Jay? Mm-mm. Got problems over in Arizona, have we? All right. Okay. She's back. How are you going, hon?
Oh, man, I don't know what happened. All of a sudden, I got a message resolving host name. And, I mean, I just dropped like a... Oh, I am so sorry, guys.
TPGRP also works on Quest. How about that?
Exactly.
Your turn to have the problems. I should have got you that extra account, but then you get now the secondary ISP to connect with. And there you go. There's a birthday present I could have bought you. Now you want a magic jack. Okay.
Well, it wouldn't help.
No, it wouldn't help. No. And they say you can't even ring Australia free on a magic jack. That's not cool. You can ring America free on engine. Okay, what I actually did while you were being absent, because I said to you, Jay, are you there? And you weren't. I read a question, and it was a scenario, one of these user-based, what licenses do we need? You up to that point in the notes, Jay?
No, I can make it there, I guess, but...
Oddly enough, it actually says Jackie's an interior designer. I didn't know you were an interior designer, huh?
That's a good trick for a blind person.
Well, I did think that when I was reading through the notes. I thought, well, good on you. Didn't even know you had those staff there scrawled away in the spare room there either, too. While Jackie catches up and comes and finds her little place in the notes, we'll talk about Amy. They spell theirs A-M-Y. My friend Amy spells hers differently. I too have a friend called Amy, and she lives in the bush. Amy's a very skilled programmer. If my Amy read that, she'd say, get off the grass and stop smoking it. She's a very skilled programmer, this particular Amy is, anyway. She is a very skilled programmer who requires a computer operating system that will provide her with the ability to make modifications that will optimize the functionality of her programs. She does not rely on structured support because she's so clever, and she's quite happy dealing with large amounts of program code. What license will she need, gang?
GPL.
GPL, yes, because she will probably be messing around in a whole heap of configuration files and programming bits and pieces of her probably Linux-based operating system.
Did you take this first one or what?
I did. I took the Jackie one. And they all came back and said that we needed a structured license, a commercial license. That's the interior designer one?
10-4. Yeah, I'm where you are now.
Good. Okay, up to scenario 3. Petros. I don't know anyone called Petros. He was given an old computer by a friend and must load an operating system to make it usable. He does not. He does not wish to spend any money on this machine, stingy, because he only intends to access the internet to view web pages. So anything's going to do. What does he want?
GPL.
And Johannes and whoever in the chat, probably Mario, said GPL. Well done. Scenario 4. Garrett. He's just got himself a laptop computer to enable. He wants to take some of his work home during the evenings or weekends. Workaholic. He wants to use the laptop to connect to the internet to pick up his web-based email. His place of employment uses Microsoft Windows XP, and all the applications that he uses only runs on these operating system. What license will he want? Mario says commercial, and somebody else trying to mic up. Sorry, Johannes, it's a bit hard to hear you there.
The question actually tells us XP, so commercial.
Yep, commercial license, so that's it. Okay, are there any other questions, comments, or feedback before we continue? This is the express leg of our journey on Chapter 2, or Leg 2 of our CCNA Discovery 1 train, because next week we start the incline up the hill, and it's going to be the first of our two-week chapters. And so you might think we're flying through this and it's all very easy, but it changes pace a little bit next week, gang, so get studying. Choosing an appropriate OS requires many factors before deciding which one to use. Now, the first step to consider is to ensure that the OS has been fully supports the requirements of the end user. Now, I can tell you a funny story here. Often people using GUIs don't really care if they know how to use GUI, and if even Linux supports it, which it does these days, you can even slip on, you're not worrying about accessibility so much, and even these days we've got Orca and that sort of thing happening. I know somebody who slipped onto a senior person's machine after all the viruses and stuff. They got sick of being hammed over by Windows and all the viruses. They put the version of Ubuntu on a machine and got Gnome and everything running with OpenOffice and whatever, probably the Evolution's mail client and Firefox web browser. And she told this guy, do not ever put Windows back on my machine again. I'm happy. And she was. So, you need to, whether it's Windows or Linux, or whichever operating system, you need to make sure it suits your user. That's why a lot of people think about getting Macs too, and they may have to go on a bit of a learning curve to learn how to use it, but that's fine. It's whatever suits the user. They're your paying customer. Does the OS support the applications that will be run? Well, sometimes there's a heck of a lot more applications available under Windows, so obviously if a person's going to be wanting to try and experiment with different new applications, they might need to consider Windows. Or is there the functionality sufficient to the needs of the user? Next, conduct research to make sure sufficient hardware resources are available to support your OS. Obviously, what are some of the basic items that you'd check for on a computer to make sure it would support your OS, gang? All right, we've put you all to sleep. I would suggest make sure you've got the right amount of RAM, hard disk, and version, everything. Make sure you've also got the appropriate amount of removable storage too, so you can back stuff up and put it in the cupboard. Another consideration, and this gets a bit different when you're in business, is the amount of human resources needed to support the OS. So there you go. If you're going to put an OS on and they don't want to pay you to keep coming back to look after it, your considerations might be different from that of a larger company with its own IT department. A company may limit the support to one or two operating systems and discourage the use of any others. That's when we start talking about standard operating environments and that sort of thing. Now, in the home environment, the ready available technical support for an OS may be also a factor too. At this part, there are some very good diagram descriptions, I think courtesy of Jan and Dean Adams, actually, that describe all this sort of stuff, so please read your notes. When considering an OS, it is also the total cost of ownership, which is the TCO, that also must be considered in the decision-making process. Where's my apple juice? Because, obviously human resources cost money. You're paying people to come and fix it or running your IT department and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, cost of installing and supporting it. I have a feeling that above point, the TCO may be something that was in the test, I seem to remember, but I could be wrong. Another factor that may come into play is the availability of the operating system. Look, I'd like to go around, if I must stick with Windows, put Windows XP professional on everybody's computers, but it's not available anymore, so we have to go with the later ones. Some countries and businesses have made a decision to support a particular type of OS. Oh no, so they may have restrictions, or companies do anyway, barring individuals from obtaining certain types of technologies. Okay, there's a few dodgy countries out there we're not going to mention.
That's happening with BlackBerry at the moment. Actually, UAE and Saudi Arabia are cutting off BlackBerry services because they don't like the fact that BlackBerry is so secure they can't monitor it, so they're refusing to support it at the moment. They're having a scrap of room over it.
Well, how about that? It's a scary thought, isn't it? There's plenty of other countries that sort of have a more global filtering capacity, don't they? Regardless of the operating system. Right, we go there. In these types of environments, it may be not possible to consider a particular OS, regardless of its suitability to the task, move house. The process of selecting your operating system must take into account all of the above factors. Whoa, guess what? Any questions before we go to Jay, who's going to take us through installing? It's pretty basic,
in fact,
isn't it?
I got to do this pretty quick, because I got a new Windows 7 64-bit quad-core processor. 4 gig memory, which is upgradable, and I'm gonna have to do this real quick. So,
if it's not done by the time I get over there, we'll do it one Sunday afternoon. How's that?
It had better be done, or I'm gonna be royally PO'd. All right. So let's talk about installing an operating system onto a computer. ITE 1 Part 2 Revisited. All right. When you install an operating system, you do so into a defined portion of the hard drive called a disk partition. Partition meaning a divider. They also use the same word, for cubicles in an office. They're divided by partitions. There are several methods for installing an OS, and the method that you choose is going to be based on the system hardware, the operating system being installed, and the user requirements. There are four types or methods of installation of an OS, which are as follows. Number one is a clean install. A clean install is basically the four methods, just for your information, are clean install, an upgrade, a dual boot, and virtualization. So let's discuss these in their turn. A clean install is either done on a new system where there is no upgrade between the current operating system and the one being installed. or where the operating system is so corrupted that an upgrade installation cannot be performed. It does delete all data on the partition, and it requires application reinstallation if it was ever there in the first place. Obviously, a new computer is going to require a clean install. The next type of installation is called upgrade. Obviously, if you're staying within the same OS platform, it's often possible, usually possible, to do an upgrade.
Scary.
With an upgrade, application data settings are preserved, so you can often just do that, and your programs will remain installed, your data will remain intact, as will your application settings. It just replaces the old OS files with the new ones. However, having said thus, okay, and it sometimes works, before doing any kind of installation of an operating system, you are advised to back up your data. And if your customer is needing an installation of an operating system performed, and it's not a new system, and he hasn't or she hasn't backed up their data, turn your face around and leave, and just refuse to do it. Or get a waiver that says, I don't give a rat's about my data, because you're going to nuke it. All right, a dual boot, you can sometimes, it's very possible to install more than one OS on a computer to create a dual boot system. It does have to be done properly, though, and because sometimes operating systems get really picky, especially like Windows, as to what partition it's installed in, etc.
Yeah, Linux doesn't care.
OS, no, Linux doesn't, but Windows really does, and so you have to kind of follow instructions very closely on a situation like that. Each OS is contained within its own partition and can have its own files and configuration settings. Basically, what happens is that when the computer starts up on a dual boot system, the user is presented with a menu that allows them to choose the OS that they want to use. Only one OS can run at a time, and obviously has full control of the hardware when it is running. The next kind of operating environment that we can talk about is virtualization. This is a technique that's often deployed on servers, and it enables multiple copies of a operating system to run on a single set of hardware, and therefore you get many virtual machines. Each of these virtual machines can be treated as a separate computer, and so it enables a single physical resource to function as multiple logical resources. Okay, so here's a student activity for you guys. Nephi's bought a computer from a friend and wants to make sure that all of the old files are removed from the system. What type of install does Nephi need?
Clean.
Excellent.
Mario now, and Kylie.
Kylie and somebody else said it too.
Mario, I think
Caroline has just purchased a new operating system, the newest version of the operating system that's currently on her computer. So what kind of scenario is this? She's just bought the newest version of the operating system.
Upgrade.
But the
upgrade.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Nigel wants to try Linux, but his computer currently has XP installed,
Dual.
I would, yeah. I would do a dual boot. All right. Ingrid has an old laptop that she has Linux on, but she wants to be able to install Windows XP, but she still needs Linux in order to do her daily work.
Dual.
Yep. All right.
Making sure Windows goes on the first active partition.
Yep. Preeti has just been hired by...
yes, I like Johannes' response. Stick it in a virtual machine. Running in a virtual machine. And I've done it too. I've Windows running.
Unfortunately, this is an older laptop. So whether it would actually, it says that it's an older laptop. So the question is, would it have enough grunt? Oh, that's a technical term, by the way. Grunt to support a virtual machine. Exactly. All right. Preeti has been hired by a company to do quality control work on their database application. There's both Windows and Linux versions of the database, and she must test out both version of the applications at the same time. She has a very high-end computer system. What do you think she's going to need here?
Virtualization?
Yeah, 10.4.
10.4.
Virtualization. Exactly. All right. One of the things that can help our next activity here is to prepare for the installation. One of the things that can greatly assist a technician in when it comes to installing an operating system is a pre-installation checklist. This will help make sure that the installation is successful, or at least you hope it will. Verify that all hardware is certified to work with the selected operating system. Well, yeah, we've talked about that. Now, this one is important. Verify that the hardware resources meet or exceed the published minimum requirements. Yeah. If you try to install XP on a Pentium, 133 or something like that, you are going to have a spectacular blow-up. And neither the XP is going to work, nor, confirm that the appropriate installation medium is available. Yeah, that's important. So often you see these people and they go, oh, my laptop's thoroughly messed up and I got malware and spyware coming out the wazoo and no, I don't have my restored disks. You guys laugh, but when you've been in this business as long as Elise and I have, you see this kind of stuff happening all the time. Mm-hmm. You know what? You just say, you owe me for the time that I spent. We've agreed on at least an hour fee. You owe me that. I'm gone until you can find your disks or order new ones or do whatever it is that you need to do to, ensure an operating system. Because I am not going to install an operating system with a one of these dodgy questionable keys or whatever. I'm not going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And you shouldn't put yourself in a situation like that either. Unless it is that they're willing to accept the free OS. Just turn your butt around and leave.
Having said that, there are unfortunately many unscrupulous people who do. They put the dodgy, very cheap for UK into the onto a person's computer when they're installing an OS. And when the whole thing craters a year or so later, the poor old customer's in trouble.
Well, and here's the thing, folks. A lot of the times, now with the validation of Windows that's occurring, if you install one of these, dodgy keys that Microsoft won't validate, then what's happened is that the user is left open to severe malware attacks because they simply cannot update the operating system. And I think shame on anybody who puts a user, especially a user who doesn't know, in that kind of a situation. I'm for having a person like that hang, drawn, and quartered.
Absolutely.
Now, if an OS is to be installed on a system that already contains data, then you need to back everything up. And if you're upgrading, you need to use diagnostic and your system utilities to ensure that the installation is free of malware. And again, back it up. Back it up? Did I say back it up? Or maybe you should back up. Yeah.
Funny about that. I think you should back it up, Jay.
Think so.
Absolutely.
If you're performing a clean install, make sure that all application software is available for reinstallation. Before starting the installation, you'll want to determine the partition structure that best meets the user requirements. One of the techniques that's often used is to divide the hard drive into partitions, for one for the operating system and then a second for data. This enables easier backup, and it tends to decrease the risk of losing data. And one of the, obviously, if the physical hard drive fails and there are multiple partitions on it, you're going to lose the data. But if the operating system gets hammed over, and that's in the C partition, then you can format the C partition, and the D partition will be left intact, and your data will be as well. Do I recommend backing up in a situation like that? What do you guys think?
Did you see my little footnote in the notes, Jay?
Yeah, 10-4, I'm just going to talk. You know, we were, Elise and I were working on her auntie's computer at the beginning of the year, and it became clear to us that her motherboard was failing, and the technician had just installed this. I mean, it was a brand new freaking motherboard. So we had her call the technician back, and Elise specified to him, give me one partition for the OS and the remainder for the data. Well, he didn't do it. She was some kind of a PO'd person, too, I'll tell you, and as was I, because, you know, I heard her specify that, and he just did whatever he wanted to do. But anyway, it does make it, you know, a good bit easier to recover from a disaster in terms of if an operating system gets hammed over, if there is a separate partition for the data.
It also enables advanced people like myself to take an image, and there are various utilities for less advanced people to take an image of that partition and backing up the actual operating system partition and just plastering the whole lot back if it craters. We call it concatenation under Linux, or DDing. And you regular listeners to Cabby will know about my trials and tribulations with all that. Mainly tribulations.
One of the things that you're going to want to do is to determine which file system to use. And this is the method that the OS uses to keep track of the files. There are many different types of file system, and some of the most common ones include the FAT file system or file allocation system. This is usually now FAT16 or FAT32. Probably there would not be any FAT16 file systems with the size of the hard drives available nowadays. It just couldn't happen. FAT16 won't accommodate the large capacity hard drives that we have today. NTFS is another file system. It stands for New Technology File System. HPFS, which is, God, that's older than the hills. It was used in the OS2 operating system. And X2 and X3, and as well as there's X4, I believe, in Linux.
EXT4,
yep. Each of these is each of these file systems tends to work with a particular operating system, although other operating systems can do it. For example, the NTFS file system is used to work with Windows, but Linux can read and under special circumstances write to it. That's kind of been Southern engineered because Microsoft really hasn't released its documentation with regard to NTFS, and so.
But it's been so well Southern engineered, I now use it reliably. And NTFS 3G now comes built in as part of the Fedora distributions.
Correct.
And has done so since version 7 and works beautifully for the Ubuntu and what's that other one? The GRML. You do have to use it on the command line a little bit separately, but it seems to work quite well.
It works okay, but the disclaimer always comes that, you know, this is experimental, etc., etc. So just be advised that it has been reversed engineered. And
whilst I use it okay, other people may not. So that's a good point. Thank you, Jay.
You need to when you're looking at choosing an OS, you need to look at the benefits of the file system and which of those are supported by any given OS that you're thinking about choosing. You can modify the partitioning structure and file system after installation. They really recommend that you not do that, because when you're modifying the file system or partitioning system on a hard drive, the potential for data loss is there. So back it up. Beep, 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 back it up. Beep, 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 back it up. All right, I'm becoming a broken record, so I'll quit.
What was that, Jay? Back it up?
Anyway, beep, beep, beep.
Didn't quite hear it.
So anyway, does anybody have any questions about this so far, about file systems and stuff like that, before I go on to configuring the operating system to join the network?
This is all what we've come to listen to.
We've put them to sleep. Good on us. All right. Yeah, what are we going to do? But we've got to do it. So, once the operating system has been installed, the computer can be configured to join a network, which a group of, network is a group of devices which are connected to each other for the purpose of sharing information and resources. I say devices because, you know, like my son-in-law, when he came over here, had his... he had some kind of Nintendo, Y, I think it was called, that he had connected to my network. So, they can be something other than computers, okay? Shared resources can...
And my internet radio connects to my network.
Yeah.
As Jackie and Kylie know a little bit about.
Shared resources can include things like printers, documents, and internet access connections. Yes, you can share an internet connection. That tends not to be done much anymore with the advent of the integrated services routers, but it still occurs sometimes. In order to physically connect to the network has to have a network interface card, or NIC. This is a piece of hardware that allows the computer to connect to the network medium. And the network medium might be things like cable or fiber optic, not usually, but yeah, sometimes, wireless, etc. The NIC can be either integrated into the computer motherboard, or it can be an installed or an external device, a peripheral device. The operating system also needs to be configured. Usually what happens is that the computer will need like an internet protocol address or an IP address, as well as other information, sometimes a computer name, etc. What you're going to learn more about in Chapter 5, I think, but we're going to touch on it just briefly now, is that there are three parts to the IP configuration which have to be correct in order for the computer in question to send or receive information on the network. These parts are the IP address. The IP address identifies the computer on a network. It's very much like the street address. So it is identifying the computer in question. The subnet mask identifies the computer network on which the computer is located. So if you think about the IP address as the house number, maybe the subnet mask identifies the street. And the default gateway identifies the device that the computer uses to access either the internet or another network. For a home user, for example, this might be your internet, your integrated services router, for example, would be your default IP. Or possibly, if you're connected directly to the internet via modem, then the default gateway would be your modem. One time when I took my laptop, I didn't have my netbook then, but I was... on a vacation, well, it was a mini vacation with my husband. He actually went down to a minister's conference, a clergy conference in Casa Grande, Arizona, which is halfway between here and Tucson. And he said, why don't you come with me? Yeah, fine, I'll come with. So I brought my laptop down, and while he was at the conference, I decided to join my creative writing group. So fortunately, I prepared the night before, and I said, okay, I'm going to get hooked up to the internet. Well, I had a problem. And I said, okay, I'm going to really be mad if I can't do this, because I had just graduated from Discovery One. So I looked at the situation, and I said, I wonder, and I looked at what they had said on the little slip, and what became clear to me was that my default gateway, the IP of my default gateway, was not the same as what the IP of their default gateway was, and I fixed it, and lo and behold, I connected to the internet. Thank you, Discovery One. All right.
So there you go. Discovery One does work.
It does. An IP address can be configured manually, usually by the network administrator, in which case it's called manual or static configuration, or it can be dynamic or automatic configuration, which is usually done by a server. Obviously, in the case of the manual IP address, it's entered into the computer by means of a keyboard, and it is static, and it's permanently assigned to that computer. Elise has, for example, a static IP address that she was given by her internet provider per her request.
Yep.
So when you have a static IP, it's manually configured. Just remember that kind of thing. And it's usually done by administrator. And that administrator also assigns the IP address, subnet mask, and default gateway addresses. All right.
Internally, on my internal network, most of it's static too. The ones I allow to go dynamic are the laptops, only because they may be taken off my network and put onto other people's networks, and I don't have to do any configuration. So that all the wired machines are generally statically assigned.
Yeah, I statically assigned my son's my son-in-law's Nintendo Y to, and the reason why I did it is because he needed a DMZ kind of a setup, and so I assigned that and allowed, because otherwise he was having trouble playing his games.
We actually assigned. Statically assign our internet VoIP boxes. So actually, I'll save it for another lecture. The story about Vicky and her DMZ, we'll save that up for another time. Kylie and Jackie know about that.
Eventually, we will discuss DMZs and all that. DMZ stands for Demilitarized Zone, by the way. A dynamic IP configuration. What happens here is that the computer is actually set up to receive IP configuration by means of the Dynamic Host Configuration Protocol, DHCP. We'll get into that later. Basically, what happens is that when the computer starts up, it's able to request an address from a pool of addresses within the network. This is usually on a server. It's a DHCP server. When the computer is done with the address, it returns it to the pool for assignment to another computer. And this is called automatic assignment or dynamic assignment. When the server sees network activity from a client, usually what happens is that there's a broadcast request to assign a DHCP IP address, and the server then complies with that request and assigns an address. One of the other things that you may need to take into consideration when connecting a computer to the network is that in some operating systems, especially Windows, I don't know about Mac, and I don't know about Linux, but computer names are important in Windows, and so each computer
they definitely are in Linux.
has to have a unique name.
Yeah.
A computer name should provide a user-friendly name, making it easier for users to connect to shared resources such as folders and printers on another computer. Elise has a whole bevy of names for her, and they're all Star Trek, except for Firebolt. I don't think Firebolt is Star Trek.
Firebolt's anyway. From Harry Potter, and yeah. the next machine won't be Star Trek, but it still will be a mode of transport, and that being Endeavour.
Right.
Americans might think of the space shuttle. We in this part of the world think of Captain Cook.
The naming scheme should, if you're in an enterprise kind of a environment, the naming scheme should help identify the machine's type and or its location, such as like PRTC. CL-ENG-01 would represent the first laser color printer in the engineering department. So it's often beneficial to, come up with a naming convention, especially in a large organization, so that it's easy to figure out, exactly where the computer is, because this can be used as a troubleshooting device in case the computers are having some kind of difficulties in terms of, being able to connect to them or whatever.
Test alert.
The names are usually manually assigned. Yeah, really. The names are usually manually assigned, but sometimes automated tools can be used to help facilitate the naming process. When you're in your systems and computer name tab of the control panel applet, you'll see a place for to enter the computer name. You'll also see a place where you can enter a description. This is optional, and it tends to just contain information on the location or purpose of the device, like mine is a netbook, So I should probably say just mom's netbook. That would be good. As I said, many of the organizations develop schemes for naming and addressing of computers. This provides guidelines and rules that can be used by network personnel when performing, various tasks. They need to be unique, and they need to have a consistent format that conveys meaningful information. This can help to determine device type, function, location, and sequence number based on the device name. IP addresses also must be unique. And Elise, it's your turn.
Thank you, Magic J, Dr. J. Any questions at this point before we go into patches?
Shoot, no, there's no questions. We bored them silly.
Absolutely. Can hear the snoring from here.
Bored myself silly. I don't know how they can not.
Oh, no. Patches, guys. Yep. When things need to be
down
fixed up.
Down by the river that flows by the courtyard.
Yeah. We need to
there
put patches.
There lived a girl everybody called Patch. Got to do something to spice this up.
Wakey, wakey, everybody. Hey, guess what?
We're up. I was just scared you got heat stroke.
Yeah, well, we've got you got heat stroke in South Africa at midnight. We're 3/4 hour away from ending this, so we're going to finish school early today. Wacko! All right. Okay. Patches are the bits of operating systems we need to apply so we can cover up all the security holes and other things. Why and when to apply them? Once an operating system or application is installed, it is important to keep it up to date with the latest patches. A patch is a piece of program code that can correct a problem or give us some enhancements. And we've seen plenty of patches that come down every month.
Or create one.
That's exactly it. They are usually provided by the manufacturer to correct a known vulnerability or report a problem. How often do you see this patch will, fix a problem? A problem has been identified that may allow a computer or a hacker to gain access to your computer. How many times have we ever read that message? Okay.
But having said that, you know what, Elise? In doing a lot of the malware removal work that I do, one of the things that really becomes apparent very quickly is that much of the malware that gets on people's computer does so because their operating system, usually it's the operating system, has not been updated sufficiently to patch the vulnerabilities that were found. And many times, like this configure worm that, that was such a big fuss made about a while back. The truth is that if the person's operating system were in fact up to date, that should not have ever been a problem. But because, many people don't update their operating systems accordingly, it became a huge problem. So.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more, Jay. It's so important, isn't it? And how many times have you and I assisted people with their computers only to find their operating system is out of date? And that's why it's a good vote for getting your operating system properly licensed so that you can put these things in without having too much grief. But, a lot of people put it onto manual updates. We've discussed automatic updates and manual updates and advised me when to install them, all that sort of stuff back in IT, and even I think this chapter or last chapter or something, and people put it onto manual and forget to do it. Okay. Sometimes patches may negatively impact the operating system. Yes, we've discussed that too. So, for us administrators and who are doing it manually, we can check and make sure that we like it, and we can make a restore point if we think we may need to roll it back. The impact of the patch should be...
We won't even go in to the horrible nightmare that I had. I had to do an update, one of the typical Tuesday update things, and the next thing I knew, my JAWS cursor, my virtual cursor was not available in web pages. I could not get the virtual cursor to work. So I said, "Oh, great!" So I said, "All right, one of the updates that I used was Internet Explorer 8." So I uninstalled it. No, that didn't help. So then I had another one that was a .NET update, and I uninstalled that, and that seemed to work, but then the problem was that those applications such as EdSharp that I used that depended on that .NET did not work, and I had to do a manual .NET repair, and ladies and gentlemen, let me assure you, that is not a trivial process. It was a bear. I mean, I spent 3 days putting that computer back. So, you know what? Sometimes these updates go awry, and even System Restore can't fix it. So, and there was no indication that, nobody puts out in the bulletins about updates. Hams over blind users' JAWS.
Yeah, I was about to say that. Cursor. Yeah, so yeah, it's a bit of a gotcha. And we had a similar problem recently. I think you said you had another .NET. I actually put that one in after you said that you thought you might have had problems with it. This is only the one about a month ago, and mine seemed to go in all right. But I remember being a little wary, thinking I do have a.
No, I didn't have any problems with it because you asked me about it. I said, "No, go ahead, put it in," because I didn't have any. So.
Oh, okay. I thought you had a problem with it the week before we did it or something. Anyway, but yes, it was nothing like last year's effort, was it? I did ask you
that was a B-word.
Sounds nasty. Can be found on the impact of the patch should be completely understood, and the information can be found on the manufacturer's website. Yes, like Jackie said, did they really put up there, "This will ham over JAWS virtual cursor for blind people on the MS website"? I very much doubt it. Patches can be installed in different ways depending on the OS and the needs of the users. Okay, this must be, there's been some test questions. I sort of merge in chapter 1, merge chapter 2 emerging. I've gone through some exam results with students, and we've talked about automatic updates and stuff here. Automatic installation. The OS can be configured to connect to the manufacturer's website and automatically download and install the minor updates without any user intervention. And the updates can be scheduled for the time when the computer is turned on but not in use. Often these things will actually occur at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I think that's in the test. So, there you go.
Yep, that's the default.
Yes, the default, yep. Prompt for permission.
The default is automatically every day at 3 o'clock in the morning is what it is.
I saw it happen one night. I was still entertaining guests at that time of the day, and all of a sudden my computer I was using as a jukebox to play music on the sound system just up and rebooted.
Good.
Yes. That's what we didn't think. Okay, it came back on all as well, but anyway. Some users like to have control.
Took a bite out of your party.
It did. Very big bite. Some users like to have control over which patches are installed. This is the choice made by users who understand the impact of what the patches are that they're putting on. The system can be configured to notify the end user that there's a patch available, and the user can then decide whether the patch should be downloaded and installed, and that's the way I have my computer set up. I did one the other day. Updates that require major major pieces of code to be installed on should be done manually, a la installing service packs, although I've seen those things come down automatically. They're often called service packs, as we know, and are designed to create problems with an application in OS, and sometimes to add functionality. Yes, we all like Windows Service Pack 3. I actually got it right. They usually require to manually connect to a website, download and install the update, and could be also installed from a CD that could be obtained from the manufacturer. I can't remember where I got my full 300 megs of Service Pack 3 from. One of my crazy friends, I would say. And that's what I just usually put it on the phone. These days. Applications patches and updates. Applications like Microsoft Office, etc., also require their own patches and updates. They're usually there to repair an undesired vulnerability in the application to correct something that's not functioning properly. Test alert! Go again. Watch for chalkboard in your Chapter 2 exam, folks. And read the question carefully.
You know, Adobe just recently had a slew of updates to correct a vulnerability that was found in Adobe Acrobat and Flash Player. Evidently some kind of I can't even remember what kind of attack was possible through it now, but, you know. So there are updates that happen all the time, and I don't know about you, but I have a tendency not to, because I get tired of Adobe every time I open it. There's an update available. I want to do is read what's available. Yeah, well, so, you know, sometimes I get a little bit, you know, I put it on manual, and I get a little bit, you know, maybe lax about that, but gosh, you know, it's a delicate balance. And so what I kind of do is I have a tendency to kind of subscribe to various kinds of technical newsletters and stuff. And, you know, if I see something come across my desk that says, oh, warning, Will Robinson, looks like there's been a vulnerability, you know, discovered in Adobe or whatever, well, then I'll update.
Yeah, it's always good to get on those sort of lists, isn't it?
I think any time that anybody is wanting to be a technician or is one, yeah, there are, you know, I think it's a good thing to find lists that are favorites of yours and get on those and keep abreast of the happenings in the IT world.
Absolutely. Windows Secrets is often good. It comes in two flavors, paid for and non-paid for. And there's a myriad of that there. Usually these patches are usually found through the manufacturer's website and usually come with no charge to the consumer. The installation process may ask for permission from the user and to verify that any supporting software is present. Yes, as Jackie just mentioned, every time she fires up Adobe Reader, as it's called now. that pretty much brings us to the end, gang. Are there any questions about patches and updates? Jackie's really explained it quite well, too, I think.
I'm good.
You good, Joe? I'm glad to hear it.
Gonna show him the video, Lee.
And here is today's Uncle Cisco offering.
Welcome. This presentation is designed to introduce you to operating systems and the role they play in computing and in the network. The operating system is the most important piece of software installed on a computer. This is the software that allows the user to interact with the computer and is in charge of the functionality and interaction of application software and hardware. It is critical that networkers know the importance of the operating system because it facilitates the configuration of networked applications such as email. The operating system also facilitates the configuration of computer networking properties such as a computer's IP address. Familiarity with operating systems and their respective user interfaces will help prepare beginning networkers for the configuration of equipment such as networked computers, routers, and switches, each of which utilize an operating system. The structure of an operating system consists of two major components, the kernel and the shell. The kernel communicates directly with the hardware of the system, while the shell allows the user to interact with application software and the operating system itself via a user interface. The shell consists of two interface types. The graphical user interface, also known as a GUI, and the command line interface. Graphical user interfaces allow users to control the computer through interaction with pictures and menu systems. They rely on user friendliness or user intuition to allow users to easily learn and perform tasks within the operating system with little or no training. The command line interface, or CLI, requires users to input text commands to control the computer. In order to complete specific tasks from a command line interface, users must first know the proper command to complete the task. This generally requires users to have a great deal of knowledge to fully utilize a CLI-based system. The Cisco InterNetwork operating system is a CLI-based operating system that allows specific control of the rich features provided by Cisco networking equipment. Just like all other software, the performance of an operating system depends upon the hardware characteristics of its host computer. Such characteristics include CPU speed, amount of memory, and hard disk capacity. The operating system's system requirements define both the minimum and recommended hardware components that are necessary to run an operating system on a computer. The minimum system requirements outline merely what is sufficient to run the operating system. Using a computer which meets only the minimum system requirements results in poor performance. Using an operating system on a computer that meets or exceeds the recommended system requirements results in an overall increase of performance. This generally leads to a more pleasant user experience. After the initial release of an operating system, its manufacturer will often release downloadable fixes which are designed to correct problems, increase functionality, and enhance the security of the operating system. Although such updates are designed to fix specific problems, sometimes they inadvertently have a negative impact on other parts of the operating system. As a result, networkers should always research and clearly understand the impact of such updates before they are downloaded and installed. This research will decrease the probability that such updates will negatively impact the computer. We will close this presentation with one example of why it is important that networkers are familiar with operating systems. One key task that is completed through the operating system is the configuration of a computer for use on a network. Besides a connection, in order to communicate on a network, a computer requires three things: an IP address, which uniquely identifies the computer, a subnet mask, which helps the computer identify the network on which it resides, and a default gateway, which allows the computer to communicate with devices on other networks, such as the internet. The IP address, subnet mask, and default gateway can be configured manually by a network administrator. This is referred to as static assignment. The addressing information can also be assigned automatically through use of a dynamic host configuration protocol, or DHCP server. Regardless of the addressing method, the shell of the operating system is used to configure how the computer will receive addressing information. you as a networker may be in charge of specifying how devices receive their addresses. Moreover, you may be in charge of the DHCP server that distributes addresses. Either way, you must be familiar with and use an operating system to complete the task. There are a variety of different operating systems available today. Examples include Microsoft Windows XP and Vista, the many versions of Linux, Macintosh OS X, Unix, and many more. Whether they are designed for personal computers, powerful business workstations, or high-end servers, operating systems have the characteristics presented in this video. We encourage you to gain experience with as many different operating systems as possible in order to better position yourself as a networker. This concludes our presentation of basic operating system concepts. We hope you have found it helpful as you work toward your career goals.
And I'm sure we will.
Do you want me to go over the chapter summary just to keep them in school longer, or should we just do the quiz and have done
that? I think we'll just do the quiz. I think we've bored this lot to death. These are all, you know, A1 IT students here, or equivalent. Anyone awake out there?
That's all.
Wine away.
So, everyone with the chat windows open, if we could please, I think everyone has, and I'll alter back to the chat screen so I can see what's going on.
A network technician needs to install an operating system on a computer in order to preserve the data application and configuration settings and partitioning already present. Which installation method should be used? Move, Magic Mouth. Do we want a clean install, an upgrade, a multi-boot, or virtualization? A is clean install, B is upgrade, C is multi-boot, and D is virtualization. Go now.
Okay, for everybody who got question B or option B, you are correct. Upgrade.
When developing a naming scheme for a network, which two pieces of information are most beneficial in choosing a computer name? We're going to choose two. So A is device type. Is device type beneficial towards choosing a computer name? B, location. Is location beneficial in choosing a computer name? C, what about year purchased? Is year purchased beneficial in choosing a computer name? Or D, operating system. Is the operating system helpful? And E, software install. Is software install helpful in choosing a computer name? Again, the answers are A, device type, B, location, C, year purchased, D, operating system, and E, software install.
Most people have answered. Yep, for those who answered A and B, which is device type and location, you are correct.
What portion of operating system code interacts directly with computer hardware? A, the GUI, B, the shell, C, the kernel, D, the window.
So everybody answering option C, which is the kernel, you are correct. Now hang on, was this with the user or with the hardware? Hang on.
With the hardware. So
yeah, with
right.
The hardware, so that is the kernel.
Which two operating systems issued under the general public license allow users to modify and enhance code? Choose two. Windows XP is A. Mac OS X is B, or OS X. C is Linux. D is BSD. And E is Unix. Again, A, Windows XP, B, Mac OS X, C, Linux, D, BSD, and E, Unix.
And everybody 100% got that right, answering C and D, which of course is Linux and BSD. Well done, gang.
All right, last question. What three factors need to be considered when choosing an operating system? So we're choosing three here. The operating system has limited availability is A. B is the operating system supports end user requirements. C, sufficient hardware resources are available. D, users can support the new software without help. And E, human resources exist to support the product. And F, the operating system is backward compatible with MS-DOS.
Right. Everybody answering B, C, and E, you are correct. Which are...
Exactly.
These haven't been annotated properly.
It supports end-user requirements, sufficient hardware resources, and human resources exist to support the product. Right.
A la big, massive IT department.
Even if it's just a wife who's a good network administrator like it is here at the house, it's still human
That's
resources
it.
Necessary to support the product. Are we done, guys?
Are we done yet?
Are we there yet?
I think we must be.
Are we in the station?
Well, I think we're pulling into the station early. We're ahead of time.
You think we're going to get in trouble for letting them out on the onto the platform and letting them disembark and go their way and get on with their lives?
I don't think so. We are asked to keep people here for 2 hours, but hey, look, this is, you know, unless anyone wants to stick around for a bit of a chat, but, you know, if anyone's got some interesting anecdotes about the day they installed their grandmother's operating system and brought the computer down the house down and blew up the suburb, then, yeah, we could all go home early.
Oh, thank you, guys. I can have 20 minutes extra sleep, so I'm going to see you guys around.
Okay, well, yes, so of course it's important, sleep, and you do have
good
to
night,
work.
Johannes.
So good night, Johannes, and thank you for staying up and putting up with us, sending you to sleep earlier than you probably expected.
And sorry about my technology.
I enjoy your lessons.
We enjoy you, as we do all of our students.
And Mario also had a internet connectivity too. Sorry to hear that, Mario. You're back now, obviously, so download the lecture. I don't know how much of it you missed. I didn't hear you go off channel, though, so by your ISP. You got TPGIP over there too, have you? Evidently so. It's contagious.
I don't know what happened on my situation, but I'll tell you what. I took a huge dive. It just kept saying resolving hostname for the longest time.
I got there when I connected through my dongle. I can't help wondering if you had a wireless funny, because, well, obviously the computer was disconnected from the network at some point. Oh, dearie me. Could have been either the ISP or the wireless in your case, couldn't it? Anyway.
Yeah, who knows?
Unless Carl's up and could have come out and said, oh, my, watching my movie downloaded and created or something, but he wasn't there, so anyway. So, everybody,
no,
thank you.
He's passed out, so.
He's passed out.
I don't
out
think we can implicate the hubby in this case.
No.
You know, we usually can blame husbands for a lot of things, but yeah, probably not this one.
No, I was thinking more or less using him as a troubleshooting step and saying, hey, Carl, did your internet drop out in the other room? But he's not there to tell us, so. Whoa, get excited, guys, because we start putting the train into a different gear and we start going up the hill. And
Is it Eva?
Do some interesting things. Yeah, well, Kylie and... Joe have had a bit of experience with this, and I think Gary too, may have from the other course, but definitely the worksheets are coming in and the level is really good, and I know there's been some discussion off channel regarding these chapters, and feel free to ask Jackie and I. We are here to help. We do not want to see you crater, and there'll be some interesting new concepts about to come away. Chapter 4 is a little bit of an English test. We learn about points of presence and connecting to ISPs. Voila. And Chapter 5 will be our addressing chapter. So Chapter 3 will be the first of the two-parters. That'll be next week and the week after. Then we'll do 1 week for Chapter 4 and 2 weeks for Chapter 5 as we head into September. So it puts us, there's a little bit of the upcoming program for you.
All right, everybody, I'm going off to cook the hubby dinner.
I'm going to go eat dinner now. Don't go eat, Jackie. You go cook, and I'm going to have my dinner now. Good job, guys. As usual, I enjoyed it. I'll catch up with you guys either on Skype or next week if I have any problems with the weather after 3 years.
Yeah, please do, guys. We don't want to see you break, because Chapter 3 is important regardless of when you do it. I think it should be done reasonably early, because it's the one with the building peer-to-peer networks. That's a good point. So, you know, I would suggest everyone go off and do their chapter threes earlier than later, to be honest. But anyway, there it goes.
I've done the worksheets. It's just I'm wading through all the concepts, because the worksheets themselves are relatively easy. Actually, that was quite fun.
Yeah, maybe next week you can tell the students. It is good, though, isn't it? Yeah. It gets you thinking about it. You can tell the students next week what you did to actually make it even more fun.
Yeah, and Britta and I are thinking of getting together again on the 20th to do a cable making. She's got all the stuff. Jackie, she used to be an installer of commercial alarm systems. They used to have to make their own Cat 5 cable, so she's got all the stuff for me to play with.
Far out. Kylie, I know that you may be totally blind, but make sure you have yourself some safety glasses, or at least a good pair of sunglasses with plastic lenses, because those little wires can fly when you cut them. And you may be totally blind, but let me tell you what, totally blind or not, if one of those happens to land in your eye, you are in a world of H-U-R-T.
Thanks for that. I hadn't thought about that, so yeah, thank you for that. I doubt if I'll be doing that side of things for a job, but hey, it's good to try.
It's good to know. And isn't it good that we've got a doctor in the house?
Exactly.
In actual fact, it was mentioned, I think, in IT. I think Jay and I may have mentioned it. So just because you've got broken eyes, don't break them
in
anything.
Chapter 1, too, because it is important. It's, you know, some blind people think, oh, it's not important for me to protect my eyes. They don't work anyway. Let me tell you what. We can get infections just like anybody else, and they can kill just as they can kill anybody else, because the structure of the eye is very near to the brain. And you know, if things get a foothold, it can be a very, very dangerous situation. Basically, there's a thing called the triangle of danger, and it pretty much goes to just, you know, above the chin to like the forehead. And it's because you know, the brain is so very close in proximity to this particular area that it's easy to get an infection going with bacteria and stuff. So it's really important, you know, blind or not, to protect your eyes.
Actually, my next challenge is going to be trying to get tactile diagrams of some of these activities in Chapter 3. That would really help, actually, a lot.
Yeah, I'll have another look at those, because there's probably some really good stuff in Chapter 3.
Do you read Braille, Kylie?
Definitely, I'm a Braille girl. I wish I had a display, actually. It's the one big thing on my wish list.
10-4. Here's what I'd like you to do. You're going to kill me, okay? What I'd like you to do is I'd like you to go to the discount store, Harvey Norman or whatever it is you have over in New Zealand. And one of the first things I'd like for you to pick up is either some kids' blocks, and that would be my preference, or some blank dominoes, and some wire and some tape, because you can make all kinds of neat little tactile diagrams of network setups and then Braille IP addresses and stuff with just those kinds of very inexpensive tactile aids.
Okay, thank you for that. Yeah, I'll do that, because some of those diagrams in the later chapter, I'm sort of working through, you know, multi-switches and multi-hubs and all that good stuff. It gets a bit complex to remember which host belongs to which.
10-4. And all you need is, the wires can also be done with pipe cleaners. You know, a little piece of tape and pipe cleaners. Those also work really well. So, that would be my advice to you.
Well, the Bunnings purchase, isn't it? Visualization can often be tricky for people with no sight or whatnot, so yeah, it's a good suggestion. All right, guys, thank you for coming here into the lecture, and it's been lovely to have everybody here.
All right, ladies, I'm out of here.
Okay, Jackie, it's good to see you.
Good to see you and talk to you again, Kyle.